Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Movie Crutch. Thought I'd mix it up a little. This is Charles W. Chuck Bryant. I'm in the home office and in the studio with guest producer Ramsey. Hi, Ramsey. He was surprised by that shout out. And this week I had another musician. They're starting to roll in now. I had the great, the perhaps even legendary Loudon Wainwright III. If you were familiar with Stuff You Should Know and our long history, you know that we made a TV show for Science Channel, weirdly, about, oh, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago. And Lucy Wainwright Roach was on the show playing Jerry. Lucy and I got to be good buddies. She is the daughter, one of the daughters of Mr. Loudon Wainwright III, along with her brother, her half-brother, Rufus Wainwright, and half-sister Martha, and her mother, Suzzy Roach. She's a singer from the Roaches, and it's just a big musical family, and it's really kind of delightful. They go on tour together sometimes still. They play shows together. I talked to Loudon a bit about the very strange Alaska train tour that they did as a family with fans on the train with them, following them around Alaska. It's a very unique approach to a tour. But he was playing right next door here at the City Winery. Lucy was kind enough to put me in touch, and Loudon said, sure, why not? So this is a great one because not only is Loudon a legendary folk musician, a Grammy winner. So now, folks, I've had an Emmy winner, a Grammy winner, and a Tony winner on the show. An Oscar, look out, because I'm going to get you in here at some point, too. So not only is he a legendary musician, but he's an actor, too. So it's kind of a double whammy. He was in MASH. He was in, very famously, is in quite a few of the Judd Apatow movies and projects. And is a good actor. It turns out that's what he wanted to do early on. And I talked to him about acting. I talked to him about his youth and, for goodness sakes, going to San Francisco, California in 1968, in the summer of 1968, to actually sit down and talk to someone who did that in the summer of love was pretty fun for me. But it turns out Loudon's a very nice guy, very insightful, very engaging. I had a really good time talking with Loudon about everything, music, life, and art, and his movie pick, Tokyo Story, from 1953. It's a drama. It's in black and white. Beautiful movie, known as one of the greatest movies ever made. But for American audiences, especially if you're my age or younger, it can be a little tough. It's a bit of a challenge, but it has great rewards when you sit down and really get into this movie. So I'm thankful that he turned me on to it and forced me to watch it. And I encourage you to watch it for sure. Also, side note, this was recorded backstage at the City Winery here in Atlanta where Mr. Wainwright performed. And so this is another one where the sound quality is a little cavernous. And apologies for that. I now have a better system for recording remotely. So hopefully those will change and be a little bit better in the near future. And this is the last one you're going to have to indulge like that. But thanks for bearing with us. And here we go with Loudon Wainwright III on Tokyo Story.
We grew up in, my siblings and I grew up in Westchester County, New York.
Okay.
About 40 miles north of the city.
Did you get into the city much, or was it sort of country living?
It was suburbs, uh-huh. You know. We would go to the circus at Madison Square Garden.
Right.
You know, and, I mean, when I was a teenager, I would go into the city and get in trouble and stuff.
Right.
But as a young kid, we were mostly out there in the burbs.
Right.
But he went to the city every day because he worked at Life magazine.
Oh wow!
Yeah, he was a editor and a writer for Life, so he was a commuter.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, and especially in those days too, I feel like Life magazine was sort of. I mean, it's always been highly regarded, but in its heyday in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
On every coffee table in America?
Yeah, that's something else.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of cool. Did that give you any inroads into kind of, did he interview, you know, like famous people and stuff like that?
Yeah, he interviewed Frank Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe. And
wow.
Was on the press... in the press corps when Robert Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles.
So he was in the ambassador? Or?
He was in the ambassador.
Wow.
Yeah, he interviewed and was friends with and wrote all the stories of the pr- Project Mercury astronauts, John Glenn and Scott Carpenter, and the guys that are in the right stuff. So he had a very exciting, you know, swinging life at life.
Right. Do you feel like that sort of gave you an at least sort some sort of peek into a world you wanted to be a part of?
Well, yeah. I mean, he ran the Life magazine bureau in Los Angeles for 3 years, and that so when I was seven, from the ages of 7 to 10, we lived in L.A. And that's when I got, you know, I had schoolmates who were whose parents worked in the movies, including Liza Minnelli. So, you know, and other kids whose fathers were prop guys and directors. One of my friends was a guy called Andy Frank, and his father was a famous director called Melvin Frank. So for Andy's 9th birthday, we went to the soundstage at Paramount and saw The Court Jester being filmed with
Danny Kaye.
So that kind of stuff, I think that's what really sparked the interest in show business.
Right.
And performing. And then musically, again, as I said, my dad's record collection was a good one.
Well, I mean, you're someone who's sort of a renaissance man as far as, you know, you've acted, you've done music, you've won a Grammy, but you've also always had a bit of a comedic edge, not only in your music, but just sort of your persona. What came first? Was it always music?
Well, I started to play the guitar when I was 13, and I didn't think I would be a songwriter. I mean, I loved, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott and certainly Bob Dylan and, you know, that whole wave of folk performers in the early 60s. I didn't think I would be a songwriter. My plan in life was to be an actor. Mm-hmm. I went to drama school in Pittsburgh, Carnegie Tech, now called Carnegie Mellon, and studied acting for a year and a half until I dropped out and became a hippie.
Okay.
That's when I started to write songs, around after The Summer of Love in 1968.
Yeah. Wow, what a scene, huh?
Yeah.
Well, Carnegie Mellon, too, that's a very revered drama school, right?
Yeah. It was, and still is, one of the best drama schools in the country.
And you enjoyed the acting in drama school, and you just...
Well, in 1967, you know, there were more interesting things than learning
than college.
Speech and voice. Well, you know, so I wanted to go to San Francisco and take drugs.
Right. Is that where you went, San Francisco?
Yeah.
Okay, so you were in San Francisco in 68?
The Summer of Love, 67.
Wow, right in the middle of it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. What was that like? I mean, people like me see it in movies and books and... It's hard to imagine what it was really like day to day.
It was fun. You know, it was a bunch of young people. I don't want to encourage the young people to have too much fun. You know, it was fun and then it got weird. You know? The fall following the Summer of Love, you know, the drugs got weirder. And
right.
The dealers from Oakland came over and there were murders and hate and, you know. But the summer was fun and loose and free music, and I lived in a crash pad with a bunch of other people, including Donald Fagen, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was out there for the Summer of Love, too.
Now, how old was he at the time? This is obviously pre-Steely Dan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was, I guess he was my age, because I think we're the same age, so...
Whatever. You guys were in your 20s then, early 20s?
Yeah.
Kind of the perfect age in 1968.
it was an enjoyable time.
Did you guys play music together? Or?
No, we were just hippies together.
Right.
One day we went to a macrobiotic restaurant, a bunch of us, and there was an upright piano in the corner, and Donald sat down and played. We didn't know he could play.
Oh, wow.
And he could really play. You know, he played some Ray Charles song.
Uh-huh.
We all said, wow, far out.
Yeah, where you been hiding that?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So, it was fun.
That's great. Now, when did you start performing in earnest, and what kind of
I got first time I got paid to play was 50 years ago in 1968. I did a show at the Student Union at Brandeis University in Boston.
And you did cover tunes, or were you writing?
No, I was beginning to write. Uh-huh. I was writing songs in 68. I made my first album in 69.
Okay.
So I had some songs. I started to write in 68, and I wrote a lot. I wrote, you know, four mm-hmm. songs a week. I mean, it was on fire.
Yeah, you had a lot to say, huh?
I guess. I mean, I was just, they were pouring out of me.
Mm-hmm. Well, your kids have all, I mean, you're one of the more famous, or I guess the patriarch of one of the more famous music families in the United States, with Rufus and Martha and Lucy, and of course Suzzy and Kate. Like, you surrounded yourself with music. Was, when they started to get into it, did you encourage that or discourage it, or was it just sort of let it be what it is?
I kind of encouraged it, I think. I mean, the Rufus and Martha were pretty young when Kate and I split up. I mean, Rufus was 3 and Martha was just a few months old when they went back to Montreal. But, you know, I saw them throughout their childhood. I was happy with it, that they were musical. And then when they started to perform and sing,
uh-huh.
Some years later, it made perfect sense, you know, because their mom was a great musician. And the same with Lucy. I mean, you know, as a kid, she grew up with, you know, going on the road with the Roaches.
Right.
And, you know, so it's always been there, guitar cases and banjo cases and pianos,
yeah,
and sound checks and back.
Inevitable.
Yeah, it was inevitable that all those kids kind of got into the family business.
Well, everyone was just so insanely talented. It's it would be a real shame. So no, Lucy didn't perform for a little while.
She resisted.
She did.
Yeah, but she finally had to cave, I guess.
Yeah, well, thankfully. I'm certainly grateful for that. What was the... I know Lucy told me about the train tour.
Ah.
How was that?
That was fun. It was not just on a train. It was a thing called the Alaskan Family Adventure. Rufus, Lucy, Suzzy, myself, and my sister Sloan Wainwright,
right,
who's a fine singer and
uh-huh.
songwriter. Martha wasn't able to attend, but we all went to Alaska. This probably was 5 or 6 years ago, and we went to, there are only about 4 places to play in Alaska,
mm-hmm.
we went to all of them.
Right.
And we took a train, and we took a bus, and we took a boat, all of that, and our audience traveled with us.
That's pretty cool.
So I actually wrote a song about it called Meet the Wainwrights. I'll probably sing it tonight.
Oh yeah? It's a fun experience?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it's weird to be with, spend all the time with the audience in broad daylight.
Right.
You're on the same, you know,
because
we're performers, and I think our tendency is maybe to hide a little until we have to go out and perform.
Right.
But it was enjoyable. We get together as a family and play. We also did the Kayamo
mm-hmm.
thing. You know what that is? That cruise that they have.
Oh, sure. That was Alaska too, right?
No, that was in the Caribbean. That was 2
okay.
years ago. We
uh-huh.
went, you know, and that was Martha. Martha came on that. So we work as a family too.
That's
we're kind of the dysfunctional Von Trapps.
Right. That's a good way to put it. Well, I mean, speaking of that, you're someone who's always certainly kind of laid yourself bare musically and lyrically, which I think, you know, makes for an audience member and a fan very relatable experience. But what does that do for you to kind of write songs that are so personal about your own shortcomings as a man and as a father? And,
well, I don't know that it's particularly therapeutic or anything. I have written very, very specifically about being a father and in this particular group of people. And although my experience is like anybody else's, that's mm-hmm. that's the thing. My shortcomings as the father are not indigenous to me.
Right.
There are many, many other fathers that have the same shortcomings, including my own father.
Yeah, I can relate.
So I write about my life, but it's your life too.
Uh-huh.
And that's why it works.
Right.
But I write specifically, it's what interests me, you mm-hmm. know, the dynamic of, I write about a lot of different things, but I certainly have written lots of family songs, and my parents, my grandparents, my kids, my siblings, the moms of the kids, the busted up marriages and stuff. It's great fodder for songs.
Yeah, that's true. Well, what about the acting? When did that, I think the first thing I remember seeing when it was MASH.
Right.
And I was a MASH nut as a kid.
Yeah.
But you acted before that, right?
Well, I had gone to this drama school in Pittsburgh, and then I dropped out. And then I was a musician, and then I was playing at the Troubadour in L.A.
Great venue.
In the mid-70s, and Larry Gelhart happened to be in the audience.
Okay.
And he was the guy, along with a fellow called Gene Reynolds, who created the TV show MASH, mm-hmm. which was, of course, based on the Robert Altman movie. But he liked the show, and he came and said, asked me if I'd be interested in being, they had an idea that one of those doctors could be play the guitar.
Right.
So I became Captain Calvin Spaulding, mm-hmm. the singing surgeon.
That's great. You were on a few episodes too, right?
I was on 3 episodes, and they're on television somewhere right now.
Uh-huh. I watched a lot of MASH growing up.
Yeah.
Because it was in reruns. 3 times a day, I felt like.
No, it was the big show.
Yeah.
Big show.
Yeah, I ended up, when I lived in L.A., I worked just on film crews, on TV commercials and stuff. We shot out of Malibu Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And I
got, where that Jeep is.
I got a real kick out of seeing that Jeep, I gotta tell you.
That's basically all that's left is that Jeep.
Yeah, sort of grass grown and rusted out. Pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
And I should mention Undeclared, too. I was a huge fan of Undeclared. And I thought that show just was a little bit ahead of its time and never got its due as a comedy.
Yeah, that was fun to do that. We didn't even get a whole season. I think we did about 21 episodes. But
that was good stuff.
It was good stuff. And Judd Apatow, of course, is a force, continues to be one.
How did you meet? How did that come about? Is he just a fan of yours?
That's what it was. He was a fan. He was a teenager living in Syosset, Long Island, and he saw me on the first incarnation of the David Letterman show, which was a morning show, afternoon show. And he thought, I guess he liked what I, he thought I was funny.
Uh-huh.
And then he, I guess, heard some of the records and came in and saw me perform in town at the Bottom Line, and which was the big club. And then years and years went by, and when he was doing Undeclared, he got in touch with me and asked if I hadn't seen Freaks and Geeks. I had no idea who he was,
mm-hmm.
but I read a script and I saw some of the Freaks and Geeks episodes, and I realized how good it was.
Yeah.
So I was very happy to do that.
Now, were you trying to pursue acting, or did jobs just sort of come to you?
I have a lackadaisical acting career. You uh-huh. know, occasionally I'll get a job. I've had small parts, and I was in this Tim Burton movie called Big Fish.
And sure.
I did a Cameron Crowe movie called Elizabethtown.
And my very good friend Stacy worked on that as a costumer.
Oh yeah.
Uh huh.
Well, we were down there in Kentucky for weeks and weeks.
She's actually from E-Town, so it was sort of an interesting uh-huh. experience for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun to get an acting job. Mm-hmm. I don't really make much of a living at it.
Right.
So, fortunately, I have folk music to fall back on.
It's kind of cool, though, just to be able to scratch that itch, if that's what you originally wanted to do.
Yeah.
To get these jobs, sort of after you'd established yourself as a musician. Neat.
It's fun, yeah.
Yeah. What about movies growing up? What were some of your favorites?
Well, you know, the movies that all young people, I mean, we went to every movie, you know, at the movie theater in Bedford, the Bedford Playhouse, you know, and that would be, you know, Gunfight at the OK Corral and mm-hmm. Shane, a lot of Westerns,
yeah.
You know, again, because when I was a young kid, because I grew up in Beverly Hills, you know, I became interested I actually went to some sound stages and saw movies being made.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always interested in seeing as many movies as I could.
Yeah.
I didn't really get into the cinema until, you know, I went to college.
I feel like that's the case usually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, it was before college. I went to a private boys' boarding school in Middletown, Delaware, called St. Andrews, and every Saturday night they'd have a movie. And sometimes it was The Great Escape or, you know, some Disney thing. But sometimes you'd get to see a real great movie, like mm-hmm. Mr. Hulot's Holiday.
Right.
Or Odd Man Out, which is a Carol Reed movie.
I don't think I know that one.
Great, great movie with James Mason. Carol Reed was the director of The Third Man.
Oh, okay.
An English guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Forbidden Games, which was a French movie. So then at boarding school, I got to see these kind of really exotic, powerful foreign films.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I went to college, so that was, college was mid-60s, so Fellini was happening, Truffaut was happening,
right.
Antonioni was happening,
mm-hmm.
Kurosawa was happening, and that was amazing.
Yeah, that was such an exciting time, cinematically.
We were seeing those movies in real time. I mean,
right.
When the Truffaut movie would come out, we would see it.
Yeah.
Because I'm that old.
Uh-huh.
I loved all those movies.
Well, being in, of course, in places like New York and San Francisco, you have the access.
Yeah, cool movie theaters.
Yeah, and like Kurosawa, when Japanese cinema hits the United States, you know, you probably couldn't have seen it in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Which maybe explains why my parents never saw stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But we can go ahead and dive into Tokyo Story, which was
your
pick for your movie crush. 1954, directed by Yasujirō Ozu. And I had never seen this movie. And let's talk about it.
Yeah,
what was your entry point for this one?
Well, you know, when I saw Kurosawa movies, you know, which are most famously, you know, The Seven Samurai and the Rashomon and those great, and Yojimbo and Sanjuro, those samurai movies, mm-hmm. lots of cutting and the excitement. I knew that I liked like the Japanese cinema in particular. But I didn't come to Ozu until later. I mean, I probably saw my first Ozu movie 25, 30 years ago. So I'm late 40s or early 50s or mm-hmm. something. There are three great Japanese directors of that era. There's Kurosawa, who's the most well-known,
mm-hmm.
Mizoguchi, who was a different, completely different kind of a thing, and there's Ozu. And Ozu is, pound for pound anyway, for me, the great one of that great triad
mm-hmm.
of Japanese filmmakers who were making... They all made silent films initially, but then they started to make, in the 40s... in Japan, they were making silent films well into the 30s,
mm-hmm.
even when there were talkies in Europe and America.
Oh, interesting.
Anyway, but... I can't remember. I think I read a Paul Schrader book that was about Ozu and Robert Bresson and Dreyer, the great Danish filmmaker. Schrader wrote it when he was a graduate student. And so I went and I saw my first Ozu movie, and I think it was Tokyo Story.
Uh-huh.
And it just killed me. I think I've seen it maybe 15 times. And we were talking. I don't know if you're what your listeners know about it, but it's a very it's about the family, mm-hmm. which is a real area that I write about and think about and am interested in. And it's about the pain of family life, mm-hmm. and specifically this movie is about ungrateful children,
right?
And regretful parents, mm-hmm. But it's all done in a very, I don't want to use to say Japanese because that's kind of silly. It's just very low key, mm-hmm. but simple and truthful. Mm-hmm. And there's no yelling and screaming, and right. There's no crying. You know, it isn't confrontational or anything like that, the way that an American movie might be.
Absolutely.
But it is so powerful, mm-hmm. and so emotional that everybody should see it. It was inspired. Ozu liked American movies, and there was a movie that was made in 1935, I think, called "Make Way for the Future." By an American director, that's a great movie, by an American director called Leo Carey. And it's about ungrateful children and parents that are aging. And I think Ozu got his idea for movie for Tokyo Story from that.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, and I'll set it up with some detail in the intro piece that I record, but I want to encourage the listeners to this to invest in it. Because I think a lot of times for American audiences, and especially, you know, if you're a little younger, older films, black and white films, foreign films, especially a Japanese film like this, it's not as accessible as on its face, but it's a movie with great rewards if you get there, you know?
Yeah.
Like you really have, like you said, it's a different culture, so it's not. And especially movies of the 40s and 50s were very melodramatic, and that was, if you do watch old movies, that's sort of what you're used to as an American. So to see this family that was just so reserved, and they didn't touch one another, they didn't hug one another, mm-hmm. and it's such a foreign concept to me as a viewer, but the payoff is it kind of gets under your skin as you're watching it.
Yeah, it's and I have to say, Tokyo Story is his most well-known movie, but he made wonderful movies, mm-hmm. and they're all, are a lot of them are about the same thing too, about parents and children, and fathers having to marry off daughters, and just the dynamic of people with the people that they're closest to, which are their parents and their siblings and mm-hmm. their kids.
Yeah, it's such a tough, it's such a universal story, I think, from everything from like the cats in the cradle to just personally with how life works with parents and children. And it's so sad in this story to see these parents. So, and you know, I say excited, they're excited in their own way, which is not outwardly excited. But when they're speaking to one another about being able to see all their children mm-hmm. in that span of a few days, and none of them have time for them, none of them make time for them, except for the widowed daughter-in-law.
Of the son that died in the war.
Yeah, the son that died, which was such a special relationship, but just underscored how sad it all was.
But the other interesting thing was... that I find about the movie is that the children, this couple, older couple makes this trip to Tokyo to see their grown kids, and the kids are selfish and they have lives and they don't really make a lot of time for them, but you understand their point of view too.
Sure,
it's very human. There's nothing. They're not villainous in any way.
Not at all.
You. It's just the way that life works, mm-hmm. and so. The characters are not, and then when the parent, well, I won't say what happens, but
no, you can say. I mean, these are all filled with spoilers. So.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's just a great movie, and it's I love it. And when anybody asks me about what movie I like, that's the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah, they sadly send their parents away. Even it's such a short trip anyway, and then they send them away to the spa, to the hot springs, and they don't want to be there.
No.
And they want to come back and spend time with their kids. They have these grandkids that are strangers.
Yeah. I should mention too, two of the actors. You know, you mentioned the character of the daughter-in-law.
Mm.
That's an actress who just recently died. She was in her 90s. Her name is Setsuko Hara. Mm. I may be mispronouncing her name. And she is in many, many of Ozu's movies. She was his primary leading lady. And she is as great as, Greta Garbo or Marlene Dietrich.
Sure.
She is such an amazing actor. Mm-hmm. And the other actor that people, if they haven't seen him, should see, is the man who plays the father.
Yeah, he's so good.
His name is, I'm going to mispronounce it too, but it's Chizu Ryo. I think that's how it looks on the page to me. And he plays a guy who's in his 60s, but in fact he was in his late 30s when he did it.
In Tokyo Story?
Yeah.
Really?
He played a lot of older guys.
Interesting.
And but this actor is, again, if you want to compare who the great American, you know, Gary Cooper or uh-huh. Spencer Tracy, in terms of being truthful,
mm-hmm.
this guy is just kills me
yeah.
when he acts. And he also is in many, many Ozu movies. So those two people, people who are interested in acting
mm-hmm.
should see Tokyo Story to see the performances, because they're all great.
Yeah, he has that one sad line. It's just heartbreaking. A married daughter is like a stranger. Mm-hmm. And it just, like, I have a young daughter now, and it just breaks my heart to think along those terms. She's not even 3 years old yet, but I'm already dreading these moments one day.
And it turns to shit.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, he and the wife have a conversation later in the film about how they should just be happy that their children are all above average.
Yeah.
They had such low expectations, I think. And they're not hard on their kids for not making time for them. They're very forgiving.
A word that's in the movie a lot is disappointment.
Yeah.
And it's about the disappointment of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another reason that it's truthful. We all start out with these wonderful ideas about what's going to happen.
Right.
And beautiful things and wonderful things can happen, but there's a lot of disappointment in life.
Mm-hmm.
And Ozu really deals very well with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and just cinematically, I mean, it's a gorgeous film, and he, especially if you're used to American movies, of course back then they weren't as frenetic as they are now, but there's almost zero camera movement. He just locks it down about 3 feet off the floor,
right?
Because they're usually kneeling or sitting.
In those little Japanese houses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he just lets, he'll start a scene many times before anyone is in the room.
Yeah.
And then he'll cut after they've left the room, but he holds it for a few beats. And I got the feeling that it was to let you to sort of soak in what you'd seen
mm-hmm.
and not just go right into the next thing.
Right, and the room is almost a character.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, these beautifully, just perfectly framed lockdown shots.
Yeah. No, he was a wonderful filmmaker.
Yeah, there's something about a movie like that that doesn't, it's not so busy, that you can really concentrate on the words and the relationship that's going on.
Mm.
I really had an appreciation for that. And then all the beautiful shots in between. He had all those wonderful, almost still lifes of
harbors and trains.
Yeah,
and
but it wasn't like a beauty shot.
So yeah, it's in black and white.
Yeah, like a clothesline or a banner in the wind.
Right.
And things like that. Just really gorgeous. Did you have an affinity for the Asian culture when you got into that, or was it?
If we go back to the, I've always been interested in Japanese things. In the Summer of Love, to jump back to that, I became interested in yoga, and I lived in a yoga ashram, and then I kind of shifted over to Japanese things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do it anymore, but I studied martial art. I studied Aikido for 30 years.
Oh, wow.
You know, I like Japanese food and stuff. So I'm drawn to Japanese mm-hmm. culture.
You still do yoga?
I swim and walk around. That's about all I can do at this point.
All right, I think that does it for Tokyo's story. Really glad you turned me on to this, because it's not a movie I ordinarily probably would have seen on my own, and now I feel like I have to dive into Ozu's career a bit more.
Yeah, there's a lot of great ones.
Yeah, I mean, and this movie is regarded as one of the all-time greats.
Mm-hmm.
I read quite a few pieces on it, and one of them was from Roger Ebert, and he just, he talks about weeping in the third act. Mm-hmm. When it's just so sad and the kind of reckoning comes for these kids who still don't really notice it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's such a sad ending.
Yeah.
And I think they talk about the disappointment of life. Just outwardly. Life is disappointing was one of the lines.
Yeah.
It's really sad. But we can wrap it up here with five questions.
Okay. Why do you like sad stuff?
No, I love sad stuff too. It's something about the warm blanket of something sad that's comforting in a way. It's weird. Mm. I like the happy stuff too. First movie you remember seeing in the theater?
Yikes. In a theater. God. So long ago. It was probably something like Pinocchio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the incredible Disney cartoon.
Right.
It was made in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So I might have got it. And Fantasia, you know, those. Because you take your kids to cartoon movies mm-hmm. first before they go to westerns and stuff. So I would say it would either have been, Pinocchio or maybe Snow White or mm-hmm. one of those.
Do you remember your first R-rated movie, or what would have been an R-rated movie?
Gee, again, not so long ago. I don't remember.
That's fine. I throw that question in there because sometimes it's a very big deal for someone to have, you know, snuck away and seen the movie they weren't supposed to see.
Yeah.
And it kind of... it was a monumental moment, but it's certainly fine that you don't remember. That's fine. Will you walk out of a bad movie when you go to movies? Will you leave a movie?
Oh, yes. I do leave movies. Mm. I'm impatient as I've gotten older. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of time left to waste at a movie that I'm not enjoying. Even movies that are supposed to be good.
Right.
You know, I don't want to name names, but I often, if I'm with somebody, I'll kind of say, I'll see you at home.
Right. You'll slip out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good move. I don't blame you. Who would play you in the Loudon Wainwright story? Ideally. And it can be from any era.
Oh, from any era.
Yeah. You don't have to name some 20-year-old kid.
Do you know who Dan Duryea was?
No.
Okay. Well, people used to say that he looked like me.
Oh, okay.
He was an actor in the 40s who looked like me. I don't know who I would play, you know. I mentioned Spencer Tracy. I mean, as long as we're heaping praise on people.
Sure.
I just saw him in another movie. On the other night on Turner, they were showing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Right.
That actor mm-hmm. is the great, great film actor. So mm-hmm. I would want him to play me.
Okay, that's great.
I'm Spencer Tracy.
Question five, and there is going to be a bonus because you're a musician. But question five. I call movie going 101. What is your ritual at the movie theater? Where do you like to sit? Do you always kind of get the same thing at the concession stand?
Well, again, I'm a bit of a cranky guy about that. I don't get anything at the concession stand. I don't like the popcorn thing. Uh-huh. I'm irritated by it.
Okay.
I talked about this thing of going to this boys' boarding school and seeing the movie that we had Saturday night. I didn't even sit with my friends. I sat away from them because it was. I wanted to absorb it. I wasn't interested in goofing around,
right. Hacking
around. It was so special,
mm-hmm.
because that life in that boarding school was pretty dreary.
Sure.
And so the movie, when the movie came on, it was magical. And now if I go to a movie and there's somebody, you know, scarfing down popcorn, I get up and get as far away from that person as I can.
All right. So solitude.
Solitude, fasting, and prayer.
All right, and then finally, we'll do a little bonus. When I have musicians on, I try to remember to ask this, but first guitar and favorite guitar.
Well, the first guitar I had was, you know, we were talking about my dad, and he lived out in L.A. We lived out in L.A. for some years in the 50s, and he had. A friend called Terry Gilkison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may have heard of Terry's daughter, would be my age or thereabouts, Eliza Gilkison. She's a singer-songwriter and a performer. But Terry Gilkison, in the 50s, was kind of a big deal. He had a group called, I can't remember the name. Anyway, he wrote a song called All Day, All Night, Marianne.
Mm-hmm.
Down by the seaside, sifting sand. It was a hit on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And he, memories are made of this. He and his two other guys were backup singers for Dean Martin on that record.
Uh-huh.
So he was kind of a happening guy, and he was a drinking buddy of my father's. And my father played a little piano, wasn't a very good singer, but Terry Gilkison gave my dad a guitar. A little Mexican nylon string guitar,
mm-hmm.
which my dad kind of tried to play and then got bored or couldn't get his calluses together
right. And
gave up. I was the oldest boy and a bit of a bully, and I pushed my brother and sisters out of the way and got that guitar. And that was my very first guitar.
That's great. How old were you? 13, you said?
Yeah, 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. So that's when I got my first guitar. Then the other question is my favorite guitar?
Yeah.
I've had some pretty cool guitars. I play Martin guitars.
Sure.
Martin Dreadnoughts. But I had a very exotic guitar, a D'Angelico, archtop, mm-hmm. F-hole. You know, it's not, it was beautiful jazz guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really a jazz player, but it sure looked good.
It sounded
good. I've had a couple of good Gibson guitars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not a guitar nut.
Right.
You know, I'm not like Steve Earle, who has 750 guitars.
Oh, yeah. But they should be played. That always makes me a little sad.
Yeah. But I've had some good guitars. And I'm a Martin man, by and large.
Me too.
Yeah. Oh, good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. All right. That's it.
Thank you.
Pretty painless.
It was painless. I had fun.
All right. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that. Loudon's a good guy. And I think he enjoyed talking to me, actually. That was my takeaway. He was a friendly guy. And we had a good conversation about his music and his acting and his art and his life and fatherhood and Tokyo Story. Really good movie. Go out and watch it. I encourage you to kind of reach beyond your comfort zone and get into some of these more, I guess if you're an American who's 40 or younger, you might consider this an obscure film, but certainly a great, great movie from 1953. So until next time, I hope you enjoyed it, and definitely reach out of your comfort zone. Go watch a foreign film. Go watch a black and white film. Go watch a film from the 1940s or 50s. Do it. You won't regret it. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.